At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
It's time for the week trending. We're joined by Jo Shea, editor of Cork Bio, and by Orla Ryan, news reporter in the Irish Times. Orla, it's been a week in which the billionaire businessman Dennis O'Brien has attracted a lot of attention by making comments about entitled graduates looking for work, and he's also condemned work from home. And we'll get to that in a little while. But before we do that, tell us about this study in Norway, which suggests that maybe heavy drinking in young adulthood can help career success.
Yeah, we might file this under potentially questionable research, but basically what they've found, in fairness, they did look at over 3,000 people over the course of 18 years, people aged 13 to 31. And they did find a correlation with people who had periods of binge drinking and how successful they were later in life. So it's kind of a questionable link, but they basically said people who were more social or maybe had less social inhibitions because they drank when they were out and about with people while in college or, you know, early on in their career, that made them maybe more amenable or more sociable, and that they met maybe good contacts and things like that. So it's a little bit tenuous, to be honest, but they were saying essentially that people, there was this correlation between people who were more social tended to drink a little bit more, not all of the time, but had, you know, binges here and there, and that they happened to be more successful a little bit later in their careers. But yeah, it's tenuous, I would say, that link.
Jo Shea, what do you reckon? Because the head researcher says alcohol may function as a social lubricant that tends to smooth career paths and ease the intrinsic awkwardness of networking.
There's probably something in that, but this strikes me as more than spurious, because one of the case studies that the guy gives, and his name is Willie Peterson, who, by the way, spent 18 years observing the drinking habits of young people, which I think basically means he hung out in pubs for 18 years and got paid to do so. But he gives an example of, as a great example of how binge drinking or, you know, hanging out with people helps you in your career. The example he gave is the Bullingdon Club at Oxford University, right? Which has, in fairness, produced two recent prime ministers of England. But maybe one of the reasons why the Bullingdon Club produces such high achievers or people who go on to great wealth and great careers is that it only is restricted purely to the most connected, most elite young people in the UK, the real top families, and nobody else can get into it. So that's kind of a ridiculous case study to advance from Willie Peterson.
Okay, well then, let me carry on with you, Joe, and just ask you about then what you think of Dennis O'Brien, the businessman's comments in relation to students and graduates coming in and expecting everything almost to be handed to them when they start their career, and giving out about them wanting, for example, to work from home rather than from the office.
Yeah, this is very interesting, because we're really seeing, there's a new trend at the moment. We're seeing Ireland now, billionaires basically lecturing the rest of us on how to live our lives and how to structure our careers and how everything should be run. You know, the Collison brothers have established a think tank to do that for us. But Dennis O'Brien made a speech in sort of the Sunday Business Post, and actually there was some very interesting stuff in it, because it was a 45-minute speech and he ranged far and wide. But the thing that stood out, and the thing that kind of most people latched onto, was he was basically saying that the working from home culture was a big part of what he saw as huge problems in the Irish economy at the moment. And he was basically kind of sounding the alarm, saying that we're heading for an almighty land if we don't cop ourselves on. I'm paraphrasing him a bit here. But Dennis O'Brien, who I think normally works from either his tax exile in Monaco. He's got a
Malta.
Malta is where he is technically tax exile.
But I think he probably spends more time in Portugal and Spain.
Spain, yeah. And I think he has a compound somewhere in Barbados or Jamaica as well. So, and works a lot from Learjets. So to be kind of to telling the rest of us that we need to get into the office 5 days a week may be coming a bit rich from Dennis O'Brien. But elsewhere in the talk that he gave, he actually made some fairly what a lot of people would think, you know, very pertinent points, especially about the planning process in Ireland, red tape around developing, red tape around establishing new businesses. So he had some very interesting things to say, but unfortunately, he kind of torpedoed a lot of his points by kind of going into this thing, lecturing everybody about working from home, which is really popular at the moment with a lot of people.
And I want to get to that in a second, but Orla Ryan, can I ask you, as somebody who isn't that many years out of college, how do you feel about this sort of labelling of the 21st century young graduates as entitled?
I mean, I'm a bit out of college at this stage, but I think, in fairness, I think it's very unfair remark, really, to be honest, to call them entitled when people are trying to have a better work-life balance. As you know, Joe pointed out there, Dennis O'Brien himself has a very good work-life balance. So I think to kind of label that as entitled is very fair. COVID, obviously, no one could have seen this coming and no one could have looked at the impact this would have had on the workplace. But we all learned that remote working is possible, not for everybody, but for a lot of people, it's a lifesaver. If you have a very long commute and you have those maybe 2 days a week where you don't go into the office, you don't have to go into the office, so you can, maybe you don't need to have extra childcare, you can pick up your kids from creche or school or whatever it might be, maybe you're looking after an elderly relative, that makes a huge difference to people of all ages. So I think to kind of come in with this sort of sweeping thing of like remote working is bad, full stop, is just, it's quite unfair.
Can you imagine what the traffic would have been like today if people weren't able to stay home and work from home, given all the rain?
Yeah, my sister had to drive from Dublin to Kildare and she said it still took 2 hours home even to get home, even though they were allowed to go out early because of the storm. So can you imagine that if everybody was trying to drive home now at 5 o'clock in the height of it? So I think it's this kind of this like broad sweeping statement of saying remote working is bad and we shouldn't have it.
But he did make comments in relation to productivity, and particularly for young people. He said that they need to be around older people in the office and they need to be having the conversations and stuff. Well, is that always true for everybody? Are there some people who actually... Joe, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I do. I work on a team at the moment and the average age, and I'm far above it, is about 23. And I actually work in a place in Cork that's got, basically, it's called the Republic of Work, and it's lots of young people working in there in all kinds of different ways, all kinds of different companies and startups. I'm looking at young people these days, and they're working three times harder than my cohort did in my early 20s. I'm knocked out by it sometimes. The pressures that they're under, the rent that they have to pay, the cost of living that they have, insuring a car, keeping it on the road. I'm constantly amazed by how hard young Irish people are working these days. And I think it's easy for people like Dennis O'Brien, you know, okay, he's a billionaire, right, fine. It's easy for him to kind of go, well, young people today, they don't know where they were born, they're not working hard. I see it every
Doesn't
day.
Every old generation say that about younger generation?
Yeah,
when
exactly.
He was coming through, wasn't there probably older generation? Isn't it the case, Joe, with every generation, you get really hard workers who are ambitious and get on, you get utter malingerers and dossers, and then you get a load of people in between. And does it really change much from generation to generation?
In Ireland these days, you have to work hard. We're a hard-working nation and you have to work hard because the cost of living is so high because, you know, people are under pressure. And this thing, like, you're right. You can't, like, older people, and people going on about, well, the reason why you can't afford a house is because you buy avocado and toast every day or you're getting your fancy coffees and all this kind of stuff. He let himself down because he did, in that speech, which was 45 minutes, he made some good, very good points, but he let himself down with that kind of stuff.
Okay, there's one listener suggesting, Orla, that a lot of people are vulnerable to finding out from their employers that they have to be on their keyboards. They can now be monitored on their keyboard work at home to see whether they're really actually working or whether they're slipping off to walk the dog or to do the washing or to collect the kids from school.
Yeah, you might need to like wiggle your mouse every now and then. It reminds me of, I don't know if you remember that episode of The Simpsons where Homer briefly had to work from home and he had the little bird that would tip over and hit the Y button on the keyboard. And that was him working for the day. But obviously that's facetious. But I think most people who work from home, they do work hard. Obviously, as you say, you will probably always have some people who do a little bit less or maybe a lot less than they're supposed to. But I think the vast majority of people, if they have work to do, they will do it.
And Joe, haven't there always been dossers at work too? The people who are always skiving off to have their cigarette breaks or their vape breaks or who are always in the cafeteria drinking coffee with people who are rarely actually at their desk, who come into work.
Exactly.
Almost to escape from home.
They'll always find a way. Dossers will always find a way to DOS. It doesn't matter if they're in the office under the eyes of the boss. They'll find a way to DOS. And some people put so much effort into DOSing, you wonder if they put half it into working, they'd probably do really, really well. But it's this working from home, everybody has targets these days. Everybody has sheets to fill out. And we have line managers and all of these sort of things. You can't really get away with it. It's really tough to get away with not working hard. And like I said, these days, Irish people work hard. We all work hard and we all work long hours. And then we have to get into our cars and drive through crazy traffic to try and get home.
Okay, let's move it on a little bit. Orla, I see the Social Democrats want to reduce the voting age from 18 to 16. What's the thinking behind that? What arguments did they put forward this week in the Dáil about that?
Yeah, so essentially they had a bill during the week. It was brought forward by Aidan Farrelly, the TD, and he was making the point that, well, for numerous reasons, but he was saying obviously that the Catherine Connolly election, that showed a real like youth movement and they, to capitalise on younger people who now perhaps have more of an interest in politics, that we should reduce the age to 16. Obviously, this is an argument that has comes up all the time. Many, many years ago when I was a student journalist, I remember writing about this for the Journal. That was a long time ago, wondering or saying we should bring it in. And I believed at the time that we should bring it in. And if you look at, Scotland or Wales or other places that have brought it in, the rest of the UK is going to bring it in the next few years. The government has said that. So I think, you know, obviously young people, a lot of them are interested in politics or a lot of them are not interested in politics, like people over the age of 18. But I suppose the Soc Dems are making the argument that you can do many other things at 16, you know, including work. In many cases, so that they should have a right in terms of voting for people who represent them.
Well, you can't drive until you're 17. You can't drink until you're 18. Should you be able to vote at 16? As one listener says that most 16-year-olds can't decide what to have for dinner, yet alone give them the vote.
Lots of adults can't decide what to have for dinner either.
They might vote or they might spoil their vote.
That's true. They might spoil their vote or they might not show out at all. Obviously, we have a lot of low turnout issues generally with elections here.
Okay, what do you think of that, Joe O'Shea? What do you think of the idea of reducing the voting age to 16?
Well, I don't think 16-year-olds in Ireland could do a lot worse than a lot of 45-year-olds and 50-year-olds at the moment, especially when it comes to spoiling votes or not voting at all. I think it makes sense because 16-year-olds these days are going to collide with reality and the economy and all of the things that they need to get on top of much quicker than they did in my generation. There used to be a kind of a lead-in time where you went to college and you had cheap digs and you could get by on a small bit of money and it was great and you didn't really have to worry about too much. But if you're 18 these days, you're straight into the rental crisis. You're straight into finding, you know, a good job. You're straight into a career or you're straight into, do I need to emigrate now like so many young Irish people do? 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds in this country, a lot of them are very politically engaged these days. I'm on social media for all day for my job and I see young people talking about the issues out there. We saw with the Catherine Connolly campaign how young people really energised it. We saw it with Zoran Mamdani in New York. It makes a lot of sense.
Okay, many comments coming in. Younger people should want to go into the workplace. They won't learn anything remotely. They just won't. If you think it's healthy for a young person to stay in their rooms, then you're just ignoring reality. Another one says, I work a lot better from home as I'm a talker and I can't help having the chats in the office. Another one says, I'm extremely lucky in my job. Full-time work from home. I can head away to the doctor, dentist, vet, walk the dogs, etc. on work time. As long as the work gets done, management doesn't care. Very respectful culture in my job. I'm 33 and I hope to retire with this company. Okay. Orla, tell us about this obesity ban, as it's been described, by Donald Trump's administration, preventing overweight foreigners from getting work visas for the United States.
Yeah, so obviously Trump has been on a bit of a mission since he returned to office in terms of cutting down on immigration of all sorts. So recently the State Department has issued a list of conditions that if people have them, that people, you know, in these visa offices, they're to think twice essentially before granting a visa to someone who is overweight or obese, maybe has a heart condition, respiratory condition, any type of cancer, diabetes, metabolic diseases. It's a long list of things. And they're saying if a person has any of these conditions, you probably shouldn't give them a visa. So I suppose
what's the thinking behind that?
At the core of this, or what they say is the issue, they want to know if the applicant has has adequate financial resources to cover the costs of any healthcare they might incur while in the States. Obviously, healthcare and health insurance more broadly is an absolute mess in the States, and that's part of the reason the government was shut down for so long recently. So essentially, if you have a healthcare issue in the States and you don't have health insurance, it's prohibitively expensive. You could very easily and quickly rack up hundreds of thousands of dollars of a bill. So, you know, the Trump administration is saying if someone's coming in and they're unwell, they have to make sure that they have to show their bank details essentially and say, well, I have enough money to care for myself if I go to the US and any of these recurring health issues, you know, they happen or I need a hospital stay while I'm over there. So I suppose they're putting it down to money that if they don't have it, that it might go back onto the US taxpayer to pay it. So that's their argument anyway.
Okay. We better be careful what we say about Donald Trump, Joshua, because we don't want to end up having to apologise to him. Tell us a little bit about something we discussed earlier in the week when we were doing TV and streaming, but an update on the BBC's position on Donald Trump.
Yeah, basically the BBC has again apologised to Donald Trump, and this is directly to his lawyers and also with a letter to the White House from sort of the acting chair of the BBC now, Samir Shah, because of course the Director General and another top person in the BBC had to resign over that Panorama documentary about the January 6th insurrection that did splice two quotes together from Trump and did actually misrepresent what he said, which was fair enough. But Trump and his team, as is their wont, went to absolute town, threatened to sue the BBC for $1 billion, which sounds like a Austin Powers line. But they actually, the BBC, interestingly, have said we're not going to be paying any compensation in this case. And it seems that they got some good, sound legal advice, which the BBC is probably right to do, and you'd expect them to do, which basically said to them, there's not a hope in hell. He doesn't have a defamation case here. So it's hopefully, the BBC is hoping this is a line underneath it now. And what's interesting is with all of the Epstein case stuff that's been coming out over the last 48 hours, and more to come, much more to come, it seems that Donald Trump is already starting to turn away and he's forgetting a bit about the BBC and he's got bigger troubles on his mind.
Yeah, but do you think, is he really going to have bigger troubles? Will he manage to muzzle the press in relation to its coverage of whatever Epstein revelations come out? Because they'll all be afraid of being sued by him.
Well, he's already sued two of the major networks, and what sued is being used lightly here. I mean, some of his opponents in the US are saying he basically shook down two networks that he thought were critical of him. And the two networks, coincidentally, were involved in major merger discussions at the time, which could have been blocked by the Trump administration. So he got $16 million and $15 million, I think it was, from two different NBC and CBS, I believe. Trump has obviously, he's intensified his war against the media. The interesting thing with the Epstein case is all of the polling is showing that actually his own base are turning against him in a huge way about this. And every attempt that he makes to shut down the discussion about the Epstein case only seems to make it worse, and nobody's buying it. So it's going to be fascinating now over the next few months to see how this all shakes out, because the media are going to follow the Epstein case to the very end.
Just back to the BBC, Orla, how is it going to re-establish its credibility and reputation after the damage done by the misleading editing on this Panorama documentary?
I mean, that's a good question, and there's been a lot of talk this week following the resignation of Tim Davey and Deborah Turnus about Tim Davey in particular, who would want to be the director general of the BBC, that it's a very thankless job. Obviously, there's been a number of criticisms of the BBC of late in terms of their coverage of different things. There's the Trump stuff, there's stuff related to Gaza and various documentaries. Essentially, I don't know. They're going to have to bring in someone who will steady the ship. And I suppose if you look at, obviously, there's been a lot of controversy, but also more people have been sharing this week as well, various research that shows that BBC does remain one of the most trusted news organisations in the world. So many people are saying, look, this is a blip, this is a bad period, that whoever comes in now will have to steady the ship and kind of regain the public's trust. But a lot of people still do have trust in that institution, despite what has happened in the last week.
And indeed, George, some of the speculation, not just in the Irish media, but in the British media, is that a chap called Kevin Backhurst might be a possible contender for the job, the Director General of RTE, given that he previously had a senior newsroom position in the BBC and has also had experience running the regulator Ofcom in the UK, that he might be somebody whose, and his name has been speculated upon in various British newspapers as a potential candidate, although there are many others.
Well, you know what? He has the perfect CV. And also, he's had a good warm-up, you know, in Ireland with RT and all the problems they've been facing, which are in a different area, but not dissimilar. A public service broadcaster that's been under fire, that's having a lot of troubles, that he has had to kind of steer through some very choppy waters. He would seem a very good candidate for that. And of course, it's a huge job. It's been called an impossible job, just like they used to say about the England football manager, but it's still the top job in broadcasting in the UK. There's one interesting thing about the BBC and Trump and his backers. BBC have been making huge inroads into audiences in the US, and some of the BBC America stuff is great, especially around the last election. The coverage was brilliant. They have 75 million regular viewers now and listeners in the US, and that may be one reason why the Trump administration is so against them.
Okay, a listener says, if Trump is successfully suing and winning against the media, what does that say about the bias in the media? Well, he's not winning in court. He's bullying settlements out of elements of the media who should be standing up to him, but for various business reasons are not doing so. And I think you find that although the BBC has apologised, it certainly won't be handing over any money to Donald Trump. So we'll see how that one actually develops. Speaking of media, Orla, tell us about this piece, great piece Dennis Walsh wrote in the Irish Times this week. Would a male pundit ever be described as the Fred West of football commentary?
Yeah, so quite the headline. It's about Joey Barton, in case people aren't aware of this case. And I was just saying, I kind of forgot Joey Barton existed until this week, till he popped up again.
Former footballer, but not just a footballer. Somebody who has, I think, serious convictions as well for assault and
serious
things like
convictions.
That.
He's no stranger to the inside of a courtroom. He's been convicted of kicking his wife in the head, of, you know, stubbing a cigar out in somebody's eye. He's done terrible things over the years. So essentially, last year, he was seemingly sitting at home watching an FA Cup match between Crystal Palace and Everton, and two female pundits were on air, Lucy Ward and Enya Luko, and he tweeted that they were the Fred and Rose West of football commentary. So in case anybody doesn't know or doesn't remember, Fred and Rose West tortured, abused and killed multiple children from the 60s to the 80s. So it's quite a leap to get from one to the other, needless to say.
Outrageous leap.
He said he was being provocative because he wanted to ignite a serious debate about whether or not women should broadcast on the men's game, which is an utter ludicrous statement to make, but we're kind of used to Joey Barton saying mad things over the years. He obviously has been found guilty and he will be sentenced next month, or we'll see what happens there. You know, the judge did say that it crossed the line between free speech and a crime. It's not the first time we've had him say something like this in terms of female broadcasters. And people might remember going back a good few years ago, it was 18 years ago, that Jackie Oatley became a female presenter or commentator even on Match of the Day, not a presenter. But there was such uproar at the time back in 2007 about whether or not a woman should comment on male sport, which is again is utterly ludicrous. But BBC Radio 5 Live did a vox pop on the street and they were asking people, like, is this okay? Can a woman comment on male sport? The Daily Mail and other places ran stories at the time and it was a big talking point. Which just kind of seems crazy now. But obviously we still have people like Joey Barton who might say that women shouldn't comment on male sport.
Okay, I want to move on to something else, Joe. Tell us about the Pope's favourite movies.
Yeah, this is very interesting because we're finding out a lot about our new Pope. And he's holding a big sort of like Hollywood kind of summit in the Vatican this weekend, I think. And it's got some interesting people, Cate Blanchett, Chris Pine, Viggo Mortensen, Dave Franco, you know, Monica Bellucci, and there's Spike Lee is going along as well, and Gus Van Sant, you know, famous directors. He's definitely a film fan, and he's talked about his four favourite movies, and there's three kind of absolute bangers, as the young folk like to say, and there's maybe one kind of questionable one. I mean, starting off with the good ones, Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, you know, which is obviously an all-time classic movie and people watch it a lot at Christmas. The Sound of Music, which, you know, is a huge movie and has a great soundtrack and a lot of people love it. And Robert Redford's Ordinary People, which was a very serious drama from 1980, won a lot of critical awards and is about life and loss and hurt. The one that maybe film critics and the public mightn't go for is Roberto Benigni's Life is Beautiful. Do you remember Life is Beautiful, which was the Holocaust kind of, I don't know, what would you call it, a sentimental drama from 1997, which actually won I think 4 Oscars at the time. So he's getting a bit of criticism for that, but otherwise, pretty sound choices.
What do you make of them, Orla?
I feel bad. I've only seen one of them. I don't know if that's good or bad. Which one have you seen? I've only seen It's a Wonderful Life. And that was a couple of years ago at Christmas. So I feel like I've seen The Sound of Music just because it's been on in the background, but I don't know if I've ever sat and physically watched the whole thing. I think it's quite a like, here are 4 classic films that won't really offend anybody if we say he likes them. So, but I haven't seen them all. So maybe they're all bangers. I don't know.
We will leave it there. Orla Ryan and Joe O'Shea, thank you very much for being with us on The Last Word to do the week trending.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.